Welcome to The Brainstorm, a podcast and video series from ARK Invest. Tune in every week as we react to the latest in innovation and reflect on how short-term news impacts our long-term views. To learn more, visit ARK-invest.com.
ARK Investment Management, LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other, and therefore ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.
Welcome to The Brainstorm, episode 73, first episode of the year, kicking it off, talking about macro and SpaceX. So macro and out of this world. Brett, you've been putting together some numbers for this year's Big Ideas presentation to come out rumored in a couple weeks, give or take. You're saying GDP growth has been roughly 3% since 1900, and it's all of a sudden going to double and potentially more than double and sustain in the next 5 years. Is that high level summary correct?
Yeah, actually not sustain. I think that my expectations is it'll more than double and then continue to escalate, as in kind of the out years of the forecast are even higher. But at a high level, GDP in 2024 is going to finish at $127 trillion globally. These are all 2024 numbers. And consensus has 2030 GDP at like $150 trillion, which works to just a little over 3% growth. So it's kind of in line with what it's done over the course of the century or century and a quarter. And we think it's going to average over 7% to $190 trillion or so, actually a bit more. And so the this may sound outrageous, but it's actually consistent with kind of like the way economic growth has worked throughout history, where you have periods of like economic equilibriums where the growth stays in roughly the same band. And then you have a technological infusion into the economy, and then there's a transformation in the rate of growth. And so the reason to be and the time frame between those transformations has been compressing over time. So this kind of step change is, call it due from that perspective, as in you could reasonably
plus or minus
say, hey,
100
this,
years.
Yeah. Well, no, more like, yeah, plus or minus 50 years, as in like it could not happen this decade, and that would not be inconsistent with long economic history. But the reason to believe it's going to happen is because also within like kind of classical economics, if you have a magical technology that allows you to basically massively increase productivity, then you can proliferate it, you know, pretty frictionlessly, you end up with these explosions in your expectations for growth. And so with what's happening with CyberCab and Robotaxi, with kind of everything on the humanoid robot side, and with all the kind of magical AI software that we're developing that should improve the productivity of knowledge work, it actually is our technology forecasts are consistent with this kind of transformation in the rate of growth.
Brett, you have the forecast out to 2030. So we should, you know, 5 years in the grand scheme of hundreds of years, not a very long time. So what do you have forecasted for 25? Because it should be pretty easy to verify if we're on track for the 2030 estimate by the end of this year. As in, we would need to see some sort of acceleration. Otherwise, your back half of your five-year estimate then needs to pick up even more than you say you have it.
Well, right? it depends on like, Sam, what is like CyberCab uptake going to be in 25? Like, so I think it's useful to think about this from the perspective of the CyberCab. Consider the CyberCab, right? So this is for the same amount of capital, you get 8x the transportation service, roughly. Basically, like you can take the same car and it transmits people around 8 times more miles than you previously had. And we have a huge, like trillions of dollars, I think, in like fixed transportation capital assets that are like sitting in the economy, right? And so what should happen with the CyberCab, with RoboTaxi, is it enters the marketplace. You get this huge labor savings from people no longer having to mechanically pilot the vehicles. And in that circumstance, those labor savings are, they're not labor that was previously like accounted for in GDP accounting, as in we don't count the wages that I should be getting for driving myself around, right? But it does mean that there should be a lot of latent demand for this. Consumers are willing to spend, a small amount of money to save kind of like a much bigger savings in terms of their wages. And so net, you not only should each CyberCab be massively economically productive as it increases economic production, but also we think very cash flow generative to Tesla. And so then Tesla is not going to take that money and stick it in its pocket. It's going to take that money and reinvest in the production of more CyberCabs. And so you end up as the productivity generating technology infiltrates the market, it actually creates the capital that you can reinvest in more of these productivity generating innovations. But imagine CyberCab launches instead of, we think it's going to commercialize in 2025. Imagine it commercializes in 2027. That would result in a very different like economic growth trajectory. But because the production function explodes, you would still end up at a really meaningful inflection by the time you get to 2030.
We're talking global here. So
yes,
the way I'll start this line of questioning is, okay, it's been roughly 3% since 1900. A lot of impressive magical technology things have happened in that time frame. I'm thinking mainly, computers, internet, all of that. Why didn't that change the trajectory?
Well, part of it is actually, it's like a GDP accounting problem, as in there's some technologies that enter the market and they create consumer surplus that doesn't get measured as like economic production. As you stated, the internet has definitely made people able to access information more quickly, for example. But what is like the net economic productivity of Google relative to the yellow pages or the library before? It's not like actually captured in the accounting statistics that well. It feeds through in terms of Google's profit, but Google is like as profitable as the yellow page companies that they pretty much killed were. Like, so there's like a, there's some stuff that, or another example is like, you can listen to any album in the world, for like at any time now. That's clearly consumer surplus. It's clearly useful. Clearly we're consuming, like the music that we get is more productive, but it doesn't show up in the GDP statistics at all. And so there's, I think, a certain class of goods that are more, call it vulnerable to that, like where kind of the measure of GDP diverges from the measure of like the actual like output we're getting out. And those are mostly in the digital, non-physical realm. The reason I have faith in the...
But both of the things you just said that we're looking forward to are physical. So in 5 years' time, we shouldn't be saying, oh, it's consumer surplus that you can get everywhere and that you don't actually need to go to a factory. Because those are real, those are much more physical activities than...
Exactly. So the translation, like the fact that AI is translating into real world, like bits, I mean, sorry, atoms rather than bits services, means that the GDP statistics should capture them. I think, like, literally, if I take the robot forecast and the robotaxi forecast, that's enough to get kind of this GDP inflection that we're anticipating. And I'm ignoring like all of the knowledge worker productivity boost that we think we get from AI software. As in, I don't need that in order to hit this change in trajectory. And there's a reason that like Elon sounding like a maniac says that, well, you know, what does money even need once we have humanoid robots? It's because like once you have like this system that can then create itself, like, you know, not only does the cost to produce kind of like physical objects, you know, collapse, but like you can use those robots to create more robots. Like you can, you basically can physically capitalize the economy much more efficiently than you previously could. And so you end up with this explosion in production that will get measured. Like I think that it's harder to ignore, call it. Go on.
Oh, I was going to say, do you think it's global enough that this is really going to do that? Or is this going to kind of be like energy charts where it's like, you know, coal's plummeting while everything else is taking off, so there's actually not a change here, right? Where it's like, you know, Europe collapses because they don't want any or too many people clicked accept cookies and it destroyed their economy. And then it's like, you know, this is happening in the US and Asia. And so it's actually all, you know, end of the day, we're still chugging along at 3%.
I mean, again, the reason this is the forecast is because they think it's going to happen. If you look at kind of the way we've done robotaxi, it takes into account some of those geographic frictions. I think that Europe, maybe consigning itself to the dustbin of economic history here, and like they may deny their citizenry like access to all of these technologies, and so, you know, well, there has already been a macroeconomic divergence between the U.S. and Europe, and you know, you could see that continue, and you could see, you know, that could become self-reinforcing in a way where it's like, you know, AI companies are already delaying their launch of tooling into Europe because they're like, you know, it's kind of a pain to navigate the regulatory state and there's a lot of liability there, which then means that kind of the European population don't have access to those tools, which then means that they're less productive, which then means that on a relative purchasing power basis, they're like less attractive as a market. And so it really could become an area that is just not well served by kind of modern technology. And that, you know, would probably be bad for the, you know, basically the consumer health and happiness in Europe, not necessarily impactful on kind of like the overall macroeconomic forecast. I think the U.S. market itself, like there's so much productivity potential here that can drive a lot of kind of the incremental. And it's possible that the rest of the world effectively disappoints. If you have like a lot of friction around adoption of technology in those specific regions, imagine, I don't know, Japan wouldn't do it, but imagine Europe again says, well, gosh, these robots, you know, we need to have a safety official looking over the shoulder of every robot that operates or something. And that sounds outrageous, but that's what they did with automobiles when they were invented. It's like somebody has to walk in front of the car waving a flag because, or else it's not safe. Well, then you're not going to get a lot of uptake of that technology in that geography.
I'm going to take the under. Not to start the year off on a pessimistic note, and I hear everything that you're saying, Brett, but you know, one of the reasons we actually started this show was to show that we do have internal disagreements and it's a constant back and forth. And I think your timeline is too short. I think 5 years is not enough time to see this acceleration. If you said 2040, I'd, you know, buy in a bit more. But I think to see this type of acceleration in terms of the adoptions and even the, you know, the forecasts you've called out, I think maybe it's a bit aggressive.
I'll say this. The way it would disappoint would be if basically like robo-taxi pricing, the robo-taxi market globally, including Tesla, but others, was supply constrained. As in, the thing that I'm curious about, and one a really important variable we have in the Tesla model, is to what degree can they production scale, right? Right now, the way the model's designed is Tesla produces incremental vehicles and a certain percentage of them become robo-taxis, not all of them. Well, I think that's conservative because like once you are in market with these vehicles, then you're basically going to be heavily incentivized to devote all of your production to producing these things. There's huge demand. You know, in the US, you need basically, I think it's like 35 million robo-taxis to then saturate the market. And so why is Tesla only designing a Cybercab plant that can produce 2 million? That seems way low relative to what global demand should be if they really can enter the market. And so then there's this question of, well, imagine they are demonstrating the demand for these vehicles and that they can scale it. Like, what is their next plant going to be? Is it going to be like, oh, now we're going to do 2 million plants like in various geographies? Or is it like, we're going to take all of the cash flow that's flowing off these things and dump it into doing like 15 million of them, you know, in a couple of years? If they do that, then you like ride down the price elasticity curve and you really can, like, it's almost like Tesla and its production could service the whole market. If they, you know, either don't do that or they can't do that because there are, you know, they're, as Sam knows, like their ability to like copy and paste factories is not quite as easy as, you know, they would like it to be. Then you know, you need other players to step in with the manufacturing chops to produce enough Cybercab or robo-taxis to like meet all of the global pockets of demand. And so then that kind of like physical friction could push out the scaling of it. But it just to actually offer a caveat here, when I looked at the medium-term forecast from the forecasting agencies last year, they were forecasting continued economic decay even over the course of the back half of this decade. So net, the medium-term forecast is already moving up for the forecasting agencies. So there is some recognition that, hey, you know, we thought that kind of basically labor declines and stuff would just cause economic decay, that, well, there's something else going on here. There's some kind of pulse of productivity that's entering the economy. I think, you know, basically it's just going to continue and it's going to build on itself is what should happen technologically. And so I agree that like, you can't say that there is like, this is the exact point the inflection is going to happen. But what I can say with some assurance is that like the technologies that are delivering this productivity are actually so cash flow lucrative for the companies that are producing them. That it actually will fund its own kind of investment, which is, you know, an interesting, it's typically what happens is actually you need a lot of labor input also to keep building. But then labor kind of digs in its heels and it's like, actually, we want a bigger share of this against capital of the profits. And so then that produces a lot of scale and friction here because it's just capital begetting capital. It can happen more quickly.
Yeah. Although I feel like normally that the labor issues come when the pie is shrinking as opposed to when it's growing.
No. Like look at the automotive industry in the US and it was still growing very quickly when labor began to like in the 50s, which is I think, when kind of labor really began to pick up. Is that, that sounds right. Or 50s and 60s, certainly in the 60s, U.S. auto was still dominant. And then that's why it was dominant. And it was basically like, you know, it allows people to be, to think that they can take a piece of the pie without hurting the growth is at a high level, I think, what happens, where it's like, why is capital getting all this money? Why are the owners getting all this money? You know, we deserve our share. And hey, we're going to like bog things down. And it was, you know, it really took a long time of kind of that sort of commercial friction being injected to allow, you know, the Japanese to grow up and come into the market and really begin to eat U.S. auto's lunch. So unless now, if the robots turn around and say, hey, we want more of this for ourselves, that could be problematic. So
people out there, you could be a union organizer for capital equipment.
Yes, exactly. That might pose an issue.
So maybe we'll end it like this. Nick, what is your confidence interval in it being less than, what's the exact number, Brett, in 2030? This way we can, you know, this will live forever on the internet.
190 trillion in 2024 dollars, 2030. GDP.
Right. And we've
consensus
all agreed we're not
150.
Saying, we're not saying GDP is measured wrong in 2030.
Confidence interval will be under the 190.
Yeah.
I would put it above 85%.
All right.
I think what you
really
said, Brett, about
it.
Not being.
You don't even believe our technology forecasts.
No, I don't believe that we can, like you said, accurately predict when inflections will happen. So my bet is it might be later than you have it built into the model.
I agree that it might be later, but I think you're not giving.
Yeah, so then you miss maybe by a couple
with 85 trillion.
You're diluting the short brevity here that we could have. Brett, what's your confidence interval that it'll be greater than that?
That it'll be greater than that? 50%.
No, that'll fine. You can say that'll be exactly that number or greater.
But it's not going to be exactly that number. As in, there's a distribution of future possibilities here. This is the midpoint of the distribution. So
you're saying it's over 50%.
I'm setting 50. The over under at 190 trillion. That's the way to think
so
about
50%.
It. 50%. Yeah.
There you have it. All right.
And Sam, you don't get off the hook that easily.
What do you mean? I'm here facilitating a conversation.
No. This is a new show. It's 2025. We all make predictions now.
All right. I'm going under as well.
Wow.
But
confidence interval. Be truthful.
Interval. Um, 60%. So I'm just shifting the distribution slightly over. Because I think there's too many geopolitical things that could also get in the way.
Yeah.
Is what I'm, I don't think we've.
I think reality is not as clean as our forecast.
We don't take that into account normally. But I do think there could be global conflicts that lead to acceleration because innovation fixes problems, but also delay the adoption.
Yes,
agreed.
That's true. I don't have the tail risk and fence injected here. This is like kind of exclusive of, I don't know, China, Taiwan stuff and other things that could throw a spanner in the works. On the other hand, if the U.S. went into a truly like war production footing, that would be, I don't know, an interesting GDP exercise.
Well, wouldn't that just shift? It doesn't necessarily mean it grows. It just shifts at certain, like for a certain period. I mean, you still grow out of it, but it would shift at first. Like
well,
you pull from one.
Yeah,
to another.
We were looking at this with respect to kind of like the eVTOL companies and drone companies too, right? Because it's like, you know, right now the U.S. is not so good at making planes. or even, you know, the globe isn't so good at doing them. China's very good at making drones. But so it's like, you know, how quickly could a Archer or a Joby ramp production? And it's like, you know, you can look at what's reasonable with recent historic norms, or you could look, it's like, if there was a wartime need, right? And Archer just struck this deal with Anduril for, you know, more defense purposes. It's like they scaled production, you know, thousands of planes annually, which would certainly be much higher than people expect.
Yeah. Well, that's what Nick, you're right in some sense, as in like, well, you're just producing military goods as opposed to domestic goods, but you motivate labor to be like, if it's existential, it's like, oh, we're going to war, then kind of like labor stops digging in heels, you know, environmental reviews go out the window. Like there's lots of political or stickiness that gets like unlocked. And you motivate capital into it. It's like you have war bonds and, you know, people are just like, why are you, you know, sitting in savings as opposed to like throwing money at capitalizing a system to like build up? And so you do end up with a big production boost, but then it comes with inflation, all kinds of other downstream stuff that wouldn't be great.
Yeah.
But not to mention war, which we don't want.
All right. So it sounds like we've all agreed that my forecast was the best.
You didn't forecast. You gave a conference. Yeah,
but where you will have money, where you will have money going is into like creating like a global net of satellites that will provide great communications almost regardless.
Great. So great
good segue. Transition.
Great segue into SpaceX's. So they released their end of year progress report. Really the biggest takeaway was the specs on the new V3 satellite. So each one is going to be 1 terabit per second of bandwidth downlink speed, which is 10x that of the version they're launching now, so the V2 mini. And it means that, you know, on a Starship launch, given it has greater volume as well, it'll be 20x the bandwidth to space with each Starship launch relative to the Falcon 9 launches now with the V2 satellite. I think more than anything that I was impressed about is, you know, this really does follow the Wright's Law curve that we published, I think, two or three years ago. And so there, it's like if you go to 2004, the cost of satellite bandwidth in orbit was $300 million per gigabit per second in orbit. You know, we estimated that a Starlink Falcon 9 would be around $40,000 per gigabit per second. So that alone, right, in that, you know, 15 to 20-ish year timeframe is a 7,500 fold decrease. So remarkable in and of itself. And, you know, all of this to say it's not stopping with Falcon 9. This is continuing on, likely getting down to the $1,000 per gigabit per second with the V3 and Starship. And of course, there's no reason to think that V3 is final. Starship iterations keep getting better. But what does the $1,000 per gigabit per second mean? It means that, you know, if you look at what a average user requires and you take into the account that, you know, these companies tend to oversubscribe because not everyone's online streaming from all of their devices at exactly the same time anyway. It's like each subscriber of Starlink could pay $5, and that would cover the capital cost of the rocket launch and the satellite itself for the service. And that's just a one-time fee. So that's pretty remarkable.
Wait, so I have a question about that. So, but that's assuming that like I have kind of these people sitting equidistant around the Earth, right? Or yeah. Is that accounting for the fact that there's like giant oceans in the way?
All I'm doing, the basic math here is to say, okay, it's like the average person uses, or what does the average person require is, I don't know, we'll say like 100 megabit per second internet, right? So that would be 10 people per 1 gigabit. But then you're saying, okay, maybe we oversubscribe this by like 20. So it's like for each gigabit, you're having 200 people subscribed. So it's not making an assumption on density.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is like we loft up 1,000 gigabits per second, right? But a large portion of those gigabits is wasted beaming down to the ocean. So, or beaming down to Antarctica or something, which is great for researchers in Antarctica. You go from having the worst internet in the world to probably having the best internet in the world in Antarctica with Starlink, because you have basically an entire satellite to yourself to like, you know, maybe not best in the world, but very good. But the net math is like, gosh, this is incredibly inexpensive connectivity from anywhere. Right.
I think terrestrial telcos should have read this and said, maybe we should reconsider some of our plans here. It's certainly a hugely impressive stat to come out. I feel like SpaceX continues to surprise us on the upside with what they're able to do from a technical aspect. Any final thoughts there, Brett or Nick?
Well, I mean, I guess I was not expecting, to me, it seemed natural that a ground-based system would always be like a superior economic model relative to satellite-based connectivity. Barring kind of niche cases where it's like rural area where like, well, you can't build a cell tower just for one person living out in Alaska. And so then therefore you don't build it. And so then that person is onboarded by Starlink. But my assumption was it would fill in kind of these pockets. And then even the T-Mobile plan that offers like unlimited connectivity, that would be a small fraction of use and kind of then therefore command a small fraction of the economics. But it seems like actually the direction they're going is they could compete more directly head to head in more areas and like more suburban areas and with kind of the cellular networks, and that, you know, these guys with their distributed towers are actually maybe in a fair amount more peril than at least we had modeled really or anticipated.
What is the ongoing maintenance costs for SpaceX and Starlink? As in, you have to continually relaunch satellites as they fall to Earth. Is that factored in here?
Well, so that's like the $5 that I cited, it's like you would charge that every 5 years as satellites fall out of the sky. But it's like you can imagine, given the altitude at which they're trying to launch, it's like, you know, we'll just say current end state rounding here, but it's like they've got 40,000 satellites at scale orbiting Earth, and a fifth of them are falling out of the sky every year. And so it's like, you know, this is another aspect that we talk about. It's like Starship could launch I think the number we have is like every 3.5 days, just to keep a constellation of that scale at full capacity.
But there's no, 40,000 is actually arbitrarily potentially low, right? Like, not do 200,000?
It depends what the FCC and will ultimately allow, right? It'll be a legal battle, I think, more than anything.
But why does the FCC get to control how many satellites I have up in space?
Because then you start, you know, Amazon comes in and says they're interfering with Kuiper, and then you go back and forth.
But it's not from a space geography perspective. You mean on the bandwidth side?
Yeah. From like a bandwidth perspective, I think is where you face it. Like from a space, I don't think you're running out of space in space.
Right. Plenty of real estate up there.
Exactly. All right. Well, this is a fun start to the year. We've got grand aspirations and a battle over the suburbs and who will connect you there. So,
I mean,
stay
actually,
tuned.
You know,
circle back in 5
kind
years.
Of, wait, just as a last weird point, but suburban life could get like bizarrely a lot better here. As in robo taxis, you know, cities have pretty good transportation networks already. Like you already have like, I mean, good but expensive taxi service. You have like much better mass transit. But suburbs, kind of one of the really bad parts about the suburbs is you spend all your time commuting around in cars to all these centers of commerce that are designed to accommodate mostly the parking of the cars. And so kind of like the centers of commerce are also, you know, these boxes and seas of parking spots. And, you know, you have, I don't know, like weird connectivity stuff. And like suburbs could become the place to be where you can get driven around and kind of like the commercial pockets could become much more interesting because you can agglomerate people in these inexpensive robo taxis like more efficiently. By the way, like your internet will be better and cheaper than you get it in the city. So it's kind of an interesting.
We'll take the over on that. I agree with you there, Brett. I think if you actually look at the history of innovation, especially with transportation, it actually led to the birth of suburban sprawl, because you could get to where you're going in a faster, cheaper amount of time. And so if that's all continuing down that cost curve, there's no reason people won't continue to move outside of cities, or cities won't just get larger by nature.
It's kind of like your workday becomes you're spending 2 hours working in the cyber cab on the way to like the lunch meeting you have, and then 2 hours back in the cyber cab still working on the way back.
That's right. Remote work isn't allowed, but in transit work becomes the norm. And then you show up for the 1 hour meeting in person. You say, okay.
Yeah, I'm going back to my office now. And it's taking me back home, and it's Starlink connected. That's the way I, you know, maintain connectivity along the way.
Sometimes. All right. Thank you, everyone.
There you go. Move to the suburbs, get a Starlink and a robo taxi. live the new American dream.